when I asked Howard Jacobson to submit a bio in 7 words, simply because I think that short bios are wonderful, he actually gave me 7 words. He was a very, very good boy. And I'm going to read them now back to him and to you all. Novelist, critic, humorist, tragedian, I don't know how you pronounce that exactly, but the next word I do know, raconteur, wit, controversialist. That is who Howard Jacobson is. Now, before bringing him on stage, I would like you to know, to hear a little bit more about who Howard Jacobson is. So, if you could play that little clip.
I cannot remember a time when I didn't want to be a writer, and specifically a novelist. I can't remember ever wanting to be anything else. I never wanted to be a sportsman. I never wanted to be a musician. I never had the slightest bit of interest in music. We were too clever at my school to be interested in pop music. We weren't interested in pop music. So when other boys had pictures of footballers on their walls, I swear this to you, or they had pictures of, you know, musicians on the walls, I had a picture of George Eliot, I had a picture of Jane Austen, I had a picture of Ben Jonson, a copy of Sargent's portrait of Henry James, which was in the National Portrait Gallery. That's what I had. They were my. I only ever wanted to be a writer, and I only ever valued writers. And it hasn't changed. I only ever value writers. Every time I meet a writer, I don't value them so much. But in the abstract, writing is the only thing. Absolutely nothing else. Never been anything else. Never.
Howard Jacobson.
Kind words. I'm very embarrassed.
Really?
Well, when I,
why?
I didn't know it was going to be announced that I had written those 7 words. I thought that they were 7 words that somebody else might have said about me, and I could have said, well, I don't know about wit, and I don't know about... Had you told me that these were the words that I was known to have said, I would have said, good boy, sweet boy, husband,
I said,
diffident, embarrassed, shy.
I said good boy,
self-denigrating. You said good boy, yes.
I said good boy.
Yes.
But what is it incorrect? Are you not witty?
No, but I shouldn't say so. I can evince it, but I mustn't say it about myself.
Well, we tricked you.
You didn't.
Now, we just heard this, I think, quite wonderful clip where, as a child already, you knew that you wanted to be a writer. This is really what your desire was. And it reminded me of Freud's fabulous line that happiness... it's a belated fulfillment of a prehistoric wish. In some way, this is, for you, always what you wanted to be, namely a writer. Only a writer. Always a writer. And I wonder why you were drawn first and foremost to the British authors, such as Jane Austen, Dickens. We might be able to talk about Dickens since you just had a very precious moment with Dickens. Samuel Johnson.
Yes.
Rather than say to Kafka, Joyce, Proust, and the other great common influences people might have of your generation.
I felt English. I felt very, very English. It took me a long time to actually also feel Jewish, although I knew I was Jewish. Essentially, I was English. I went to an English school, an English grammar school. We had a cross on our blazer. Some of the Jewish boys tried to shorten the cross so that it wasn't a religious symbol, but I was all right with having a Christian symbol on. For 10 years of my life, I wore a Christian symbol near my heart, on my jacket, and on my cap. I was full of a sense of being an Englishman. I went to an English university. I studied English literature. I lectured in English literature for 15 years or so. I'm an Englit man. It's in my bones. My school, no, the school teachers who affected me were Englishmen. There were boys at school who were interested in American literature, and I always thought they were a bit sharp. You know, what's this with American literature? You know, they talked about Hemingway and things, and I was reading George Eliot and Jane Austen. They were going to Hemingway. I always thought there was something a little bit fraudulent about them. And I had boys at school, friends at school, who spoke French and Spanish, and they liked French and Spanish writers. And I always mistrusted them because they knew how to pronounce. How wonderfully you pronounced, was it Verlaine you spoke about today?
I could have very well. Verlaine.
See, already I hear Verlaine, yeah. And I think, what's with the pretentiousness? And,
right.
Which is, this is folly, isn't it? But it's...
Well, it's another way of putting it is that you don't know how to pronounce French.
That's a very, very good way.
I mean...
There are some who say I don't pronounce English very well either, since it's, you know, I'm a northerner.
But let's go a little bit... You're from Manchester, if I'm correct.
Yes.
All right, but let's go a bit deeper into this, because why the choice of those writers in particular? Why Austen? Why Dickens? And why have you remained, as it were, faithful to those writers? Why, if a house were burning now, which books would you save? Which one book would you save?
Well, I'm very divided. I would immediately say Great Expectations.
Okay.
Because I do think that's the most perfect novel ever written, and I think it's the best Dickens novel ever written. And it's the best novel about sex ever written. Though people don't know how to read Great Expectations. One day I'd love to give a major lecture on Great Expectations to explain. And sex is one of my subjects. I only have two subjects, Jews and sex. Occasionally I put them both together, and in some novels you get Jews and sex. They are my most successful novel. Dickens' Great Expectations is one of the great novels about sex. And then I think, would I want it to be Middlemarch, which is the most intelligent novel ever written? And then I feel guilty about it.
But not the most humorous.
No, it's not the most humorous novel. And I always say a novel has to be humorous, otherwise I'm not interested in it, which would make you wonder why I would then choose as another novel I would rescue Women in Love, which isn't funny. Though I have given a lecture on the comedy of Women in Love to an absolutely empty and stunned lecture theatre. What is he talking about? And even I knew I'd failed on that one. I feel a desperate need to argue for comedy in novels always, and to find comedy in novels which I love, even when the comedy isn't there. Because if there isn't comedy there, why do I like it so? Why do I like Lawrence so much if he isn't funny, and I insist on funny? So I'm divided all the way here. And then I'd go, forget all that lot, have... Do you think Verlaine. Did Verlaine write a novel?
No, I don't think Verlaine ever did.
Well...
He may have. I don't think so. I think he was mainly known as a poet and, of course, a very close friend of Rimbaud.
And Baudelaire?
Baudelaire didn't really write novels. He wrote essays, he wrote fragments, he wrote aphorisms... He wrote about how much he hated Belgium.
He wrote a very good essay on comedy, too, Baudelaire.
He wrote a very good essay
on comedy. Yes.
What do you remember about it?
I remember him saying that had God not failed in his design for humanity, there would have been no comedy. Had life been perfect, had Adam and Eve gone on getting on well as the perfect couple, there would have been no comedy. So the snake is the agent of comedy.
He also said that even if God didn't exist... it wouldn't be enough of a reason not to believe in him.
That's very clever. They're so clever, those French. Reminding me why I prefer the English, because the English are more straightforward. You don't have to do what they say. You don't have to do cop-drainished. Do you know that expression, cop-drainished? The twisting of your head to one... You don't do cop-drainished with George Eliot or George Eliot. You just kind of... They're straightforward.
Before coming down here... We were up there in the Berg collection.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about what you saw and what moved you.
I've just been shown, I never think of myself as... Well, I do know I'm a very sentimental man. As I've become an older man, I realize I am a sentimental man.
With age.
So with age, yes. But I was always a sentimental man, and I denied it. I hid it. I hid in a room when I was a little boy and listened to sentimental music. And that room, which you rightly said had pictures of Jane Austen and George Eliot and Henry James in it, I would lock the door and I would play Mario Lanza records. And also Italian operas, particularly those Italian operas in which prostitutes die of starvation and tuberculosis. And I, as a 12-year-old boy, knew all the arias that the Adolfos and the Rodolfos sing at the deathbed of these consumptive whores. And I didn't know what a consumptive whore was, but I sang songs. They broke my heart. So I knew I was sentimental, but I never told anybody about this. I tell you now, for the first time. This is the first time I've come clean about this. And you could see why my father, you didn't mention this either when we talked about those photographs that I had on the wall, why my father thought I should go and see a psychiatrist. They also heard the sobbing coming from my room. They probably thought I was sobbing at the portrait of Jane Austen and Henry James. They didn't know about the music thing. That wasn't your question, though.
No, it wasn't my question, but you know what? I'll come back to my question. Let's just play a little bit of clip number two, the audio clip.
Sul mare luccica l'astro argento placida in l'onda prospero il vento sul mare luccica l'astro argento placida in l'onda prospero il vento.
Okay.
No, stop.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm cutting short your pleasure.
Yes.
So that was Mario Lanza. And you listened to
yes.
that.
Yes. And I was mad about Neapolitan. That's a Neapolitan.
Yes.
I was mad about Neapolitan songs. I didn't know when. I knew no more about Naples than I knew about whores who were dying of stuff. But I had longed to be a Neapolitan. There were pictures of Mario Lanza that I saw and Gigli, who was small and round, and Caruso. These small, round, Italianate men who were versions of Jewish men in their own way. Little round men. And they always wore striped shirts, little striped shirts. And I fancied that I saw myself like that. It's not all that unlikely. I didn't come in a little... Had I known you were playing that, I'd have put on one of my little... And they're always
you
singing
have some.
Goodbye. Goodbye to Sorrento. And I sang goodbye to Sorrento. Where the hell was Sorrento? But I was singing goodbye to Sorrento. I find this stuff very, 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 very powerful. Goodbye. Goodbye songs. Goodbye
farewells.
To prostitutes. Goodbye to Sorrento. Goodbye to Italy.
And in many ways, some of your books are goodbyes.
Yes.
They are elegiac in that
yes.
way.
Yes. And I never knew that I would be elegiac. I didn't think I would be elegiac. I didn't think I possessed that. I'm still trying to remember what your first question was.
I do remember it. That's part of my job.
I'm trying to snake my way back.
You see, it's interesting, rather than giving you the pleasure of telling you what my question was, it's interesting for me to discuss with you what you find faulty in Milan Kundera. In Milan Kundera, what you find faulty is his assessment and his assertion in The Art of the Novel, which I find rather interesting and great, that the European novel sort of took a bad turn, not really fulfilling the promise of Laurence Sterne, and that Laurence Sterne, in a way, was underexplored and underused. And you prefer going in a different direction. Though at the same time, you would join Sterne in his notions about digression, where he says that digression is the sunshine of narrative. You don't really use the word digression as much as the word convolution.
The trouble with Sterne's digressions is they're not very good. I have no problem with digression. They're just not very good digressions. Sterne is tedious. I agree with... I'm very much a reader of Kundera. I admire Kundera enormously. I think what Kundera says about that the novel begins as a comic form, as a place where we learn to disobey the law, as a place where we learn to deride religion and our leaders, and so it was from the very beginning, the novel. This place of criticism of everything. Fun and mirth and riot... Absolutely agree with him. That's what novels are. That's what novels should be. And any novel that's not like that, i.e. Women in Love and Middlemarch, are not doing the job that novels should do. That my only argument with Kundera about this is because he doesn't read English, because English isn't his native language, he doesn't hear that Sterne's faulty. He doesn't hear that. So as a general critic of the world novel, his idea that digression became a necessary thing and we could throw in Fielding as well as Sterne, I absolutely agree with. But what Sterne creates his own tradition, not just of digression, but of jocoseness, jocosity. Humour that's not funny. The non-funny novel. I daren't name any names, but the non-funny novel.
Oh, go on.
Which normally wins the Booker Prize. until I changed all that. And that creates the kind of there's a kind of English magic realism. The English can't do magic realism. If you want to do magic realism, you have to be born in Mexico or anywhere in South America. But the English, and I don't think the Americans can do magic realism either. And when they try it, there's always Sterne there in their way. Over-digressiveness, facetiousness, rudeness that's not really rude. The great English, we're not, this is not the place where we're going to talk about the history of the novel, but I think
I think the
English novel finds its voice not in Sterne but in Dr. Johnson, who criticizes Sterne, who says nothing odd will last long. Dr. Johnson says when he reads Sterne, and people go, ha ha, you got that wrong, Dr. Johnson, Sterne did last. Well, he got it wrong, Sterne did last, but for all the wrong reasons. Someone once wrote that Marx was influenced by Sterne. Now, is this a great thing? That Sterne is to blame for the Berlin Wall? Is that what we're proud of? Whereas in Rasselas we get an entirely different tradition of moralizing that looks as though it's taking itself too seriously, but doesn't take itself too seriously, of a kind of melancholy, of a plangency, a disappointment, and it's not footling about. You don't get the English novel does not start. Nothing happens after Sterne. Maybe Thackeray. Dickens isn't out of Sterne. Dickens is out of Dr. Johnson. Dr. Johnson, Jane Austen, Dickens, the Brontes, George Eliot, Lawrence, Hardy, me. I'm not Sterne. I've got nothing to do with Sterne. I do digress. I'm digressing now. And digression is one of the great joys of the novel. But it's got to be funny. Sterne's just not funny. Have you tried reading any recently? It's about noses and it's not funny.
What's not funny about noses? Do you want me to reiterate my question?
Yes.
Okay. That's a problem with digression in part.
You lose where you're going, yes.
Yes, which is one of the joys.
You lose where you're yes.
Yeah, yeah. Because yeah. In losing your way, you also discover all kinds of new things.
You do. I'm not against that. Digression is a good thing.
But you would like to know what the question was.
Yes.
Okay. The question was quite simply what you felt and what you discovered upstairs when we were upstairs.
Upstairs.
Yes, upstairs.
I've held Dickens' pen.
Yes.
I've had this tiny little, just a little stick. It's barely bigger than a toothpick with a little nib on the end. I've held this evening Dickens' pen. I've seen a Dickens reading copy of The Christmas Carol in which he does what I do when I prepare bits of things to read. And I was sort of ashamed that I did it, and I would have thought Dickens wouldn't need to, where he cuts bits out and pastes and crosses things out and says and gives instructions to himself. That goes, read this weirdly, add in intense pathos, take yourself slow. It gives instructions to himself. But he gave these wonderful readings. Dickens wandered around Britain and gave readings to 5,000 people. It killed him. The readings killed him. He couldn't stop doing it. He was the last of the novelists as entertainer. I'd love to be in that. I'd love to be able to do that now. This is part of lots of novelists think, why have I got to do this? For me, this is a very important part of what being a writer is, the performance art of writing. I write. My sentences are written to be heard, and if I can actually then speak them to an audience, that's perfection.
Before you do, because I would actually like you to prepare to read a doctored piece
I'd like you to read an intensely doctored piece.
But before you do, let's go back to the pen. Holding Dickens' pen. What was your first reaction? Do you remember it?
Yeah, I was touched by it and felt close to him. I almost felt it was like an ancestor, like a relation. It's like discovering something that your great-great-grandfather used and had. It was that feeling, partly familial. I have no right to feel, you know, I'm Dickens' family. I can't say that. That's like saying that I'm a wit and a raconteur. It's not for me to say that I'm Dickens. You can say I'm Dickens' family. They can say I'm Dickens' family. I can't say I'm Dickens. But nonetheless, I felt like Dickens' family. And there was his writing desk. It's very touching. And today, I was close to, at the Waldorf Astoria, I was close to Cole Porter's piano. So in one day, I've seen Cole Porter's piano, where some of those wonderful songs got written, and Dickens' pen. And now I'm talking to you.
I don't know how to take that last comment.
Take it in the best way.
Okay, I will. You know, you're not being completely... maybe you're just misremembering, which is possible. I was going to say you're not being completely accurate. I think you're misremembering. When you held Dickens' pen, your first reaction was that it made you incredibly sad.
Yes, it made me sad because it's the past and Dickens is no more and we are mortals, and you know, and there with that pen, and he was called the immortal, and there with that pen he wrote forever, and the words are there forever, but he's not there forever. Loss. It made one think of loss. You can't hold an object that's had so much life. I mean, it was such an inert object,
and
such an unbeautiful object,
and
just a plain thing, and so much vitality in that. I mean, of all writers, you know, you feel that anything that they've touched, you feel the vitality of that writer, the most vital of writers.
And you were also so interested because it was such a slim little bit.
A little bit of nothing. And I have these banks of machines that I work with. Computers, which I kind of hate and love at the same time. Every time I hate the computer, I go out and buy another one. I rail against the computers. I'm a Luddite. I hate this machinery, and I've now come to be dependent upon it. And he could do it with that little pen.
Yes, I mean, you've made some comments. You said recently that Facebook and Twitter will kill us. You mark my words, you said. We might not be around to see it, but Twitter will be the death of us. We'll be Twittered to hell.
This is the Jewish prophet in me. Elijah, standing on the mountaintop, telling the children of Israel, you will Twitter yourself to hell. But it's true. I mean, they're just wittering, people talking about nothing.
And Twitter's witter.
It is what it sounds as though it is. And people, the whole internet business of what people go into print on. The internet was bruited as something that would have marvelous democratic effects. And people would say, well, look at the wonderful effects it's having in the Middle East at the moment. Well, we shall see. We shall see, but for the moment, okay. But the idea was that people who never had a voice before would suddenly be able to write would be able to blog, or would be able to answer something that you write. They get these little streams underneath your articles, and they can join in the national dialogue. And this would make it possible for people who haven't earned their rights to be a novelist or don't have a job on the paper to have their word. What do we discover? There is nobody out there who's not working for a newspaper or hasn't published a novel who's got anything to say. They haven't got anything to say. They're crazed. They're crazed with envy, malice, jealousy. They hate you. I have poison. I can't even look. I don't look anymore. I know not to. But at one time, I used to look, and you write an article, nice, friendly article about something or other. Say, you know, Twitter will send you to hell. And then this filth underneath. May you die. From people twittering me, or whatever you call it. And there's also, people mistake expostulation for thought or for criticism. They think they can just burst into anger, into rage.
I'm curious about that, nearly neurologically speaking. You know, what have these machines done of us as readers? So that
it's very interesting. Well, what do you think?
Well, it's a good question, and we can
come back to it.
Will you remind me?
Yes,
but quite frankly, I think it's a question I'm haunted by. My 92-year-old father, very recently seeing me on a BlackBerry, and my children no longer think that a BlackBerry is a fruit. I mean, they see me on this machine, and everybody in New York is walking around, you know, davening into
a BlackBerry.
And you keep bumping into people. Yeah. But he said to me, and I think quite accurately, you know, the biggest mistakes I've made in my life have been mistakes I've made because I've answered too quickly. And I've just, and this kind of machine yes. makes you answer quickly, yes. and it also makes you react immediately. You're looking for the red light to pop up. You're seeing if, you know, it used to be the days when we had answering machines, and if there was no message, you felt that you were not loved. Now you look at this yes. machine, and if there's no emails from someone, you feel maybe less important. But more importantly for me is the notion of what attention we need to dedicate, to devote to Great Expectations or to the Russian great novels, which you haven't mentioned yet. But I mean, you need in order yes. to read to sustain effort, you need an attention
yes.
span,
yes.
which is a deeply religious thing to be attentive.
And we don't believe in it anymore. And we used to study at school. We were given a novel to study, and we would take half the year to study. We would read. Week in, week out, we were reading the novel. Now in English schools, they don't even finish a novel. They have a bit. They have an extract. A friend of mine was saying the other day, oh, she was so delighted, she said, that her daughter was reading Jane Eyre. Isn't that wonderful? So she said to the daughter, so what do you think about the fact when Rochester, you know, gets in the fire? The daughter said, oh, I don't know. That's the end, isn't it? We don't do the end. Do a little bit. That's The experience of art, the lived experience of art, that idea is over. Visual arts, that's perfectly clear. There's nothing to even stand and look at anymore. There are no paintings to stand and look.
Are you sometimes worried, though, that you're not just an old fart, nostalgic?
Oh, I'm not going to have any of that. That's the young trying to get... No, I'm not. I am old. I am wise. I am quick. I'm a raconteur. I'm witty. I'm... and it's no argument against me that I'm old. Any more than it should be an argument against them that they're young. Except it is an argument against them that they're young. Because they're innocent and inexperienced and they don't know anything.
Since you do like talking about the recent prize you got, I'd like you to tell us a little bit how this prize came into your life, and more importantly, since after all, a prize that is given to a nice Jewish boy precisely comes into the life of the mother. The mother usually is yes. the one who is yes. really either disappointed or happy, yes. and
well,
why were
you
not a doctor? And I mean, all of those kinds of questions.
I will tell you. I am the first Jewish man ever to have won the Man Booker Prize. No Jewish man has ever won the Man Booker Prize. No Jewish male novelist. Not that there are many Jewish male novelists in England. I know people in America were astonished to discover that there are any. You mean there are Jews in England? They write? You can write in England? There are one or two Jewish women novelists, but no, very few Jewish male novelists. And the idea of one winning one was astonishing. And you don't expect it to happen. And my mother rang me, my mother who's still alive and now in her late 80s, rang me about 2 weeks. I was short, you're on the long list for weeks, and then you're on the short list for weeks. It's weeks and weeks and weeks of getting the plats,
because yeah.
you're waiting to know what's going to happen. And my mother rang me a week before the prize was finally announced, and she said, I want to talk to you. It's very important, darling. You're not going to win this prize. And I said, well, I know I'm not going to win this prize. She said, no, but I want you to know, I've just read it. She doesn't read everything I write, but I've just read it. She said, it's very, very good. It's too Jewish. She's not going to win the prize with this book. It's too Jewish. And she rang me up again. I said, I agree with you. That's fine. She said, so you're not expecting? I said, no, I'm not expecting. She rang me up again on the morning of the prize. She said, are you still not hoping to win? Because you're not going to win. I said, no, I'm still not hoping to win. My mother has always, her entire job in life has been to damp down my expectations, but only in order that I should not be disappointed. So, for example, I remember vividly when a telegram came to say, when I was 19, to say I'd got a place at Cambridge. And my mother I have this picture of my mother bringing the telegram to me in bed. I don't know what I'm doing in bed, because that's not my sense of being a young man, that I was in bed and my mother brought me things. But on this morning, my mother, for some reason, brings me the telegram. And I open the telegram and I go, I'm in. And she went very still. And she said, I think we better check the front of the envelope again. It might not be for you. This was not cruelly meant. So come the prize, and I am the only cool. It's a big, big dinner that you have on the night of the Man Booker Prize. And I believe my mother. My mother says I'm not going to win. And I'm the only calm person there because I know I'm not going to win. And I'm absolutely calm. And people all say, if you're shortlisted, you'll not be able to eat or drink. And I'm eating and drinking, and people are looking at me. People are actually thinking, I must know I've won. I seem so confident. In fact, I know I've not won because my mother has told me. She'd also said, so I won't be watching it on the news. It's a very big deal. I don't know how it's reported here, but in England, it's a big thing. You're on the news at night, and she said, I won't be watching because I don't want to see you not winning because you know you're not going to win. And I said, well, there's no point in you watching because I won't be on and you don't want to see anybody else winning. Have a good night. We'll speak soon. So I win the prize. And then I'm swept away into press conferences and things, and I'm not able to ring her up for about an hour. So I ring her up when I get the moment, and I say, I've won it. She said, I know. And I hear a party going on at home. All celebrating and people... Jewish songs being sung, like Seder night. she said, I decided in the end I would watch just in case, and I watched it on the news. She said, but you made a speech, and I thought it looked a really good speech, and then your speech was interrupted. She said, I am so annoyed. Speech was interrupted because they said, we've got to move now to Chile, where the Chilean miners have just come out. She said, the Chilean, they've been down in there, in that mine, for 6 months. She said, would 10 more minutes have made that much difference?
But, you know, it must be... Before you read the passage, because I really would like people to hear your work, it must be substantial to what it means to have Jewish parents, because I remember when I got my PhD doctorate, my father, you know, said, big deal, you know, you have PH in your name already. One letter, you know, one letter for five years. And then he sent me a cartoon from the New Yorker where you see a man taking a reservation, a maître d' taking a reservation, and the maître d' says, is this for... a medical doctor or a mere PhD? You know, they put you down. But your father, I mean, I don't only want to stress your mother, because your father also played such an incredibly important role in your family, especially I know that there's a story you once told me of him taking you on the train and putting you on the train to Cambridge.
I'll tell you about my father. We have a moment for me to talk.
We have a moment for, absolutely.
All right. My father is, in my novel, The Mighty Waltzer, my table tennis novel, which has just come out here. It was never published in America before, but now I've won the Booker Prize. Every word that I have ever written will now be published. Aren't you lucky? And what that novel partly celebrates is the two sides of my family, which is my story, actually, which is that my mother, who was the bookish one from whom I learned to read and develop a passion for things English, because she would read to me from Palgrave's Golden Treasury, very, very quiet, shy family, all of them.
Father and mother.
Withdrawn. My mother, withdrawn. My father, entirely the opposite.
Yeah.
My father, who was a market man, a taxi driver... a magician, a children's magician. Whenever we went to a family wedding, you could see which family was which, because there was my mother's family, all sitting in a corner, red with embarrassment, and there was my father's family doing the conga and conga lines of these women, noisy women. It was very odd, because my mother had come from Lithuania. My mother's family were the Mitnagedim, the Jews who say no to everything. My father had come from some hysterical part of the Ukraine where they say yes to everything. So it's two entirely different ways of being Jewish in my life. And at some point in every family gathering, my father would suddenly start lifting a chair from... He could have lifted this table from... On his knees, in his dinner suit, lifting a chair with one hand. And everybody gathered round and clapping and people doing kazatskis and my mother's family shrinking further. And I'd see my mother thinking, oh, my father's lifting a chair again from one hand. And then, and when he was a very powerful man, very short but very powerful man, he could lift a chair with my mother in it. But my mother didn't want to be in a chair that my father was lifting in it. My father once did a trick. It was one of his. It was a trick he had to do to become, to be join the Lancashire Magic Circle. You have to do a presentation, and his presentation, which he'd been practicing for ages, was to do levitation with my mother. He wanted my mother to lie on a table, and then he wanted to levitate. My mother did not want to be levitated. She was a quiet, shy woman. She didn't. So he got this idea that what he would do is he went to an early version of a sex shop in Manchester and got a blow-up doll. And the idea was, and then he asked to borrow my mother's clothes to put on this doll. So he dressed this doll like my mother. It's a very odd experience for a Jewish boy to see his mother dressed as a sex blow-up doll object. Then he thought, well, he can do even better than this, because the doll could be flat to begin with. So the doll was flat to begin with, lying on this kind of like, it was like an operating theatre, but it was like a stretcher, flat on this thing, covered up. And then he was an inventor as well, and he made this pump, which he used so that the doll, without anybody watching, the doll would suddenly blow up and assume the shape of a person, the shape of my mother in my mother's clothes, and then would rise. So he pumped it up and it rose. There was my mother lying there, and it rose, and the pump jammed. This is absolutely true. And he couldn't stop the thing rising and rising, and also the air going into the doll, so that the doll got larger and larger and larger. It rose to the ceiling, something like as high as this, where it exploded. So there is my poor mother and her sons looking up and watching her clothes and all her underthings coming floating down from... So my father was this boisterous, larger-than-life man who had I think I only became a serious writer when my father died, I needed tragedy, but I also
needed not to be so coddled by him.
Well, he protected me all the time because he was so. I mean, he physically shielded me. I used to go with him in his van to the markets. And in those days, vehicles were always breaking down and cars were always crashing. And almost every Saturday night, we'd see some car crash. My father would somehow see it, stop the van, go running out, rip the doors off the vehicle, pull people out of bleeding vehicles and things, out of flaming vehicles. But always, I'd come running over to see what was what, and he'd always do that. Wherever I was, my father's hand went like that, over my face, to stop me seeing life. Anywhere I'd be, that would happen. I'd be out with my friends.
And so his death was...
Yeah, that's right. I'd be out with friends, seeing things, and suddenly, what's my father doing here? So on my final day, when I'm leaving home at last to go to Cambridge, because that telegram saying I've got a place in Cambridge was indeed for me, so I was going to Cambridge, and my father took me to the railway station and shook my hand. This is my first day as a man. I'm finally free from my father, and he's protecting me from accidents all the time. Always an accident. I'm a burning house or something, and my father doing that. I'm free from it. He shakes my hand and bangs me on the shoulder, because that's what men did in those days. There was none of this hugging and kissing and things and saying, I love you, Dad. We didn't do that. It was bang, 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 punch. You knew your father loved you if you were bruised. That's how you knew. So he shakes my hand, he punches me on the shoulder, he takes my case, he puts my case up the thing, he says, well, off you go, you know, off you go to life, sits me down in a seat, I'm sitting there, and suddenly, he sat me down opposite a dead person. A corpse. I thought this was a rather green-looking person I was sitting. On my first day of life, my father sits me opposite a dead person and then covers my eyes, takes me off the train, stops the train, organises things, gets the police, gets the... Stop this train! I want dead man in here. So off I went to Cambridge, entirely shrunken person with no confidence at all, and stayed that way for years.
Yeah, because Cambridge was not the best experience.
Cambridge was no good for me. But it did mean that when my father died, I was, you know, released in that usual way of sons when their fathers died, that the front, you know, the protective line has gone and there's just you. But there was also nobody to do that.
I love this afterword in Roots Schmutz, which I'll read just before you read from the Finkler question. Not long before he died, my father reminded me of an anecdote which he hoped would go in this book. He knew that I'd loved it when he first told it to me a couple of years earlier. We both felt it was the final word on the subject, containing all we knew of the absurdities and the pleasures of being Jewish. My father was a magician in his spare time, a member of a magic circle and a children's entertainer. One day he received a request to do a party for an Orthodox Jewish family. They had one stipulation: no rabbits. Intrigued by this and wanting to know where he stood halakhically, so to speak, when it came to rabbits and the Orthodox in the future, he consulted a rabbi. The rabbi asked for time to deliberate on this, to consult sources, the Torah, the Talmud, the opinions of the sages. He didn't feel it was a matter he could pronounce on just like that. A week later, he contacted my father, Mr. Jacobson. He said, "Max, I have given your question the most serious thought. I have looked at it in this way and I have looked at it in that way. I have read and reread everything the great scholars of the past have written on the subject. I have taken into account the Mishnah and the Gemara, the laws relating to animals and the laws relating to magic. And the ruling I have reached is this: listen, if they don't want rabbits, don't give them rabbits." Let's hear from you now.
It touches a sore point, actually, because my father, I had a white rabbit when I was a little boy, and my father asked if he could borrow it to do magic tricks with. And he had a very successful night once. He kept it here in his pocket and would pull it out, and the kids all loved it. Then he came home very, very excited, put the rabbit back in his coat pocket and forgot to take it out, put his suit away in the wardrobe. And only days later did we all remember that my poor rabbit was in there. The next time he tried to pull it out, he pulled out a dead rabbit. So he didn't have a lot of success with rabbits, my poor father. So I'm going to read something from The Finkler Question, my novel is the reason I'm here. This is a scene in which a 90-year-old Czech man called Libor Sevcik, who's lost his wife and is mourning his wife. They'd been married for 60 years. Her name was Malky. He'd been a show business journalist, and he'd loved her, although he'd been a friend of Marilyn Monroe and Sophia Loren and all these people. He'd still loved his wife. And now he doesn't know what to do with himself at this age, but still missing her intently. And his friends, worrying about him, organize a kind of date. They say, "Go out with this younger woman." "What's your favorite color?" she asks. "Oh, Mozart." "And your star sign?" "My eyesight." "No, your star sign. Star." "Oh, star, Jane Russell." So had begun Libor's first date of his widowhood. The girl, she must have been in her late 30s, but that still made her a girl to Libor, did not appear to know who Jane Russell was. Libor wondered where the problem lay, in the accent he had not quite lost or the hearing he had not quite kept. It was beyond his comprehension that Jane Russell could simply be forgotten. "Russell," he spelt out, "R-U-S-S-E-L-L, Jane, J-A-N-E, beautiful big." He did the thing men do, or used to do, weighing the fullness of a woman's breasts in front of him, like a merchant dealing in sacks of flour. His date for the evening looked away. She had no chest to speak of herself, Libor realized, and must therefore have been affronted by his mercantile gesture. Though if she'd had a chest, she might have been more affronted still. The things you had to remember with a woman you hadn't been married to for half a century. The feelings you had to take into account. A great sadness overcame him. He wanted to be laughing with his wife Malky over it. "And then I..." "Libor, you didn't." I did. "And then I..." "Libor." Libor sighed, wanting it to be over, and showed the girl his hands. The flesh disfigured with liver spots, was loose enough for her to slide her fingers under. It would peel clean away like the skin on a lightly roasted chicken. His knuckles were swollen, his fingernails dull and yellow and bent over at the ends. Then he ran his hands over his baldness and inclined his head. He had always been a balding man. Balding had suited him, but he was plucked clean by time now. The patina of extreme old age was on him. He wanted the girl to see her own reflection in his head, measure all the time she had left in the dull mirror of his antiquity. He could tell she couldn't figure out what he was showing her. When he used to present his bald head to Malky, she would polish it with her sleeve. It used to excite her to do that, not just the head, but the act of polishing it, as though he were her furniture. It amused him to be her furniture. "You can open my drawers whenever you like," he would say, and she would laugh and cuff him with her sleeve. At the end, when she was dying in front of his eyes, they had talked dirty to each other. It was their defense against pathos. She wanted him to laugh because they had laughed so often together. Laughter had been her most precious gift. Laughter had been his most precious gift to her. And now, at the last, she wanted laughter to be her final gift to him. "I'm sorry," he told the girl, calling for the bill. "This isn't fair to you." She was as relieved as he was when they parted.
It's a real mixture of melancholy, mourning, and pathos, and the necessity you feel of laughter. Laughter, perhaps, as a necessary ingredient in the moments of extreme pain.
Yes, yes. I think it is. I think laughter is the most precious thing, the most binding thing, human to human. I think anybody you don't laugh with, you don't really know. I think anybody you don't laugh with, you don't love. I think if you don't share that, what do you share? If your eyes don't meet over laughter, if our eyes don't meet together over laughter.
You made me laugh quite a lot so far.
I watched your eyes water with laughter before, and that for me was the highest thing. I could have stopped then, caught the plane back to England and been satisfied.
Stay a
while. I made you weep with laughter.
That's all there is. But do you sometimes laugh on your own? Do you make yourself laugh even
when I'm writing? Yes, yes.
But other moments when you're writing because what you're writing makes you laugh.
Because I've made myself laugh. Yes.
Because the other day I was in a meeting in a PTA meeting at school, and I was writing actually an email to a friend, and my wife and some other friends next to me thought that I just had received a note that was very funny, when in fact what was making me laugh was what I had just written. Do you have that?
Yes. I make myself laugh more than anybody else makes me laugh.
You do?
I probably became a comic novelist because I wanted to read things that made me laugh and couldn't find anything. After Dickens, so I thought, well, I'd better do it then.
You better do it yourself.
I'd better do it myself.
A subject that haunts you, I think, is the subject of mourning, the subject of loss. And the character that you just read about is possibly the character in your novel I would ascertain you love the most.
Yes, I think that's right. And I also think that's probably the best thing I've ever done is Libor. People say to me...
But why? Why? Because he's old? Because he's been in love with the same woman for 60 years?
Yes.
Because that proves...
Yes.
What?
I'm very touched by the old. I didn't know. I used to be very frightened by old people when I was a boy. Old people, like children and old people, they're the same. I didn't know what they were going to do. I was frightened by them. I was embarrassed by them. And as I've become old myself, I've become very attached to even older people. Libor is he's 90, and he's partly based upon somebody I met. As I was beginning this novel, I met this person fortuitously. I've noticed this happens a lot. God gives you something that you need. If he likes the novel you're writing, he gives you something that you need. Here, nah, you've been a good boy. Nah, have this. So he gave me the original for Libor. And one of the things that I loved about him was age 90, there's no diminution of his physical powers, of course, of his body, of course.
You like that?
What I like is that the fact that emotionally he's as alive as anybody else. Absolutely. You don't, because we often think of, you know, we're fond of the old and the rest of it, but we feel, well, you know, they're a shell, and that might be the case. In this man's case, he is completely alive, emotionally alive. And he misses this woman. He longs for the company of this woman, every day for the company of this woman. He misses the future with this woman. He doesn't just miss the life that they had,
but
they could have gone on to. And you think, well, what? You're 90. What would you have gone on to do with this woman? She was 88, you're 90. The whole future he misses. He misses eternity. We all want eternity. I mean, being mortal is unbearable. It's unbearable. And to see a man that age still wanting life so badly was both wonderful and terrifying at the same time. So that touched me profoundly and made me find a way of touching nerves in my writing that maybe I'd not done before. And the whole character of Libor, I think, he is my triumph, I think, so far. Because of that.
Because for quite some time, as I age too, it's a subject that I'm so interested in, is the relationship of age to. In your case, you were talking about age to physical prowess, age,
yes,
which is an interesting subject,
yes,
for men, also for women, I imagine.
And age to feeling. Do you go on? Is it wonderful that you go on feeling everything that you've felt? Or is it terrifying?
And what do you remain faithful to? What did you, when you were a child, love that you still love when you grow older?
Well, I love my grandmother. And when my grandmother died, that was the first shock of my life. My grandmother, who'd more or less brought me up. I had this blissful beginning when I was, you know, born in 1942 with the bombs falling everywhere, and I'm my mother's first child, and my father is away in the army, and around the bed as I am delivered into the world, like one of the babies in Dickens, you know, as I come into the world is my mother, of course, without whom, and her mother and my mother's sister, all shy Lithuanian women. For whom I am the most amazing thing that's ever happened. And I remain the most amazing thing that's ever happened for 4 years. They are amazed by me, by everything I say and everything I do. Look at him, listen, look, what's this? Ever seen anything like that? And they go, do a little dance, so I do a little dance. And remember, my mother says, look at him, look at the long legs he's got. He's going to be a dancer, he's going to be... And I was this little short, fat thing. They were just amazed by me. And this is, in a way, it's had a bad effect because I remain astonished by myself. Look at me, I sometimes think. Look what I can do. Look at the long legs. Look at the long dancer's legs I've got. Look how astonishing I am. And I love the three of them, and the three of them love me. And then tragedy strikes. I mean, here is where here's where I become a writer. I'm an entertainer until that. I do little dances for them, and I make up songs, and I make up. And they're going, oi, what a, oi. And then my father comes back from the war ends, and my father comes back, and there's somebody else now that's taking up time. Not that they're going to him. Oi, look at him there. What long legs he's got. My father's legs stopped there, so they knew he wasn't going to be a dad. But my father is back, and then the most terrible, terrible blow to me happens. I leave my mother's house. My grandma lived five doors down. My grandma says, you're going to come and live with me for a few days. And I'm four, and I've got whooping cough, I've got the measles or something. One of those things you're not meant to go near a pregnant woman with. I don't know my mother's pregnant. In those days, you didn't prepare people. You didn't go, and you're going to have a nice little brother and buy him a present and listen and talk to him. There was none of that. Everything was silent. Not a mention of it. I'm just removed from the house. And then one day my grandma says, right, now we're going to walk back to your house. So she takes me by the hand and we walk back to the house, and there is my mother in the window with my rival, new, just arrived, this new minted thing, which she's holding up like that, like a cup. Like the thing I won when I won the Man Booker Prize, holding it up like that. Look at that, look at that. Throwing it, man, putting it in my face. It's so Freudian, it was, you know, my mother's always said, I don't believe in Freud. Oh, I've not got no patience with that, I don't believe in Freud. No wonder she doesn't believe in Freud. Like that. So that was the end of my life, really. And now they're all going, oh, look at him, but except it's not me, it's my brother. And a new word has entered their appreciation of my brother. Because in all the words about me, it was how clever he is. He's smart, what a sense of humor he's got. With my brother, suddenly there is a word, beauty. Look how beautiful he is. Oh, isn't it so beautiful? They ask me, look how beautiful he is. And they never, ever use that word. So there is my, and that is the moment when I am, we talked about Baudelaire and comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
And comedy is when, you know, the Garden of Eden is over. That was the Garden of Eden over. And that's, if you like,
stone,
when creativity,
stone, yeah.
Yes, and humour, but bitter, angry humour against myself and against them all, enters at the age of four.
I was going to read this passage, which I adore, on page 267, for those people who will go for a book signing afterwards. I hope you all do. And I'll just read a couple of lines, because I think they're extraordinary. The worst times Libor remembered were the mornings for her and for him, but it was her he was thinking about. There was never making any peace with it. Neither had what could be called religious faith, both rejected false consolation. But there would be an hour, there would be the lights, when the lights were dim, he would lie by her, stroking her hair and holding her hand. And later on you say, it was bearable then, not a piece of resignation, but an engagement of the fact of death with the fact of life. Though she was dying, they were still living together. He would turn the lights out and return to the side and listen to her going off and know that she was living with dying. But in the morning, the horror of it returned, not only the horror of the pain of, and what she knew she must have looked like, but the horror of the knowledge. Mm-hmm. And this is a passage which is highly serious. Yep. And where you are mourning the fact that there is really no consolation.
Yeah.
There is no real substitution. After so much time together, there's nothing else.
Nothing else in the daylight. Only the night. The night there is an opportunity. At night, as we, you know, as something happens to our bodies and we drift off into sleep. I've often thought that at night I could face any news. Okay, if that's to be that. Because when you drift off into sleep, it is a little death anyway. I mean, you must have felt this when you're small. Will I wake up? How terrible will it be if I don't wake up? And at night, somehow you can reconcile yourself. It's the unbearableness of the mornings. And there are several scenes in this novel about the morning.
Unbearable.
How terrible the morning is. How terrible just the light shining upon the cruelest facts of life. And the cruelest fact of life is that we have it for only a short time. It's unbearable.
And what you find so energetic in your character is the fact that he still, at the age of 90, has such energy,
yes.
Is partaking. I recently read, for no particular reason, simply because I was digressing in my library, a passage from Cicero where he talks about aging as if we were on stage. And as if we were the public looking at a play. And as we age, we get further and further and further removed from the stage, to the point that we're sitting up in the balcony. We're still partaking in what's happening on the stage, but the characters have become tiny, 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 smaller and smaller,
yes.
And smaller. And this character, this is not happening to him.
That's the dread. You kind of hope that age will give you that. that age will give you... I mean, that sounds quite hopeful, the Ciceronian thing. That age will give you a kind of distance, a philosophical distance from which you slowly, slowly part from life. And as you slowly part from life...
The emotions are less...
Yes, and you see this as a natural thing. A natural fulfillment of being in life is that you part from life. But what if it's not like that? What if you don't feel it's a gradual parting from life? But what if you're taken out of life screaming for more? Those are the things that terrify me. Will I be taken out of life screaming for more? Will I do not for one moment feel, I'm not 90 yet, but I'm moving there.
You have some years.
A little bit. But there is no sign at all of my being physically reconciled to the end of life at all.
Do you fear it?
Yes, I fear it. Yes, I do. And I fear it for those I love, too. So I wrote that scene, and I'm glad you liked it. because I think
it's an incredible scene.
I wrote it out of dread. I didn't write it out of knowledge. I wrote it out of dread. This, I thought as I was writing it, I must put down what I dread more than anything else. And this, I dread, is what it will be like. The night, if this happens to me, or if it happens to the person I love most, to my wife, this will be the most terrible thing. The morning after the night.
How do you sleep after that night? You ask. How do you sleep?
Yes. That's what the character Trezlov asks of Libor. How the hell do you go on? And it's not something I understand, how people go on living when somebody that they are as close to as he was to his wife. How do they go on? And I'm fascinated. And now, of course, I am at the age when, you know, we lose our friends. So half the people I know are widowed or widowed in one way or another. And I stare at them. I look at them. How are you? Can't ask them, how do you do it? You can't say that. How on earth do you do it? But I stare. And I'm astonished that people in the main are able to do it. How? What do we find?
What do we need?
Need doesn't come into it. We would be other. Life would be other if we could make it so. But the fact of mortality is what colours everything, and it's what, in the end, it's the other side to laughter. I mean, we talked about laughter. I mean, those are the two balancing things, which is why in the passage that I read, I imagined her thinking that she wanted to give him laughter at the end. And the man who I was partly thinking about when I wrote that did tell me, he gave me that thing that they talk dirty to each other. He said we had this most passionate love affair, and we were tender and delicate with each other. We never swore or anything, but at the end of their life, they swore and they made themselves laugh raucously, Rabelaisianly, because it was their defense against the sadness was too unbearable. I thought that was fantastic that could be.
You recently wrote to me that you're never happier than when I'm confounding the solemn with laughter and filth, and confounding the light-hearted with moral seriousness. What did you mean?
Well, every time I work out my position about the comic.
Yeah.
And think, you know, I'm in a world of... and if you are... I mean, I've been called a comic writer for years, and I don't
and
really
don't,
like
don't like
don't
it.
Like it. Well, because it sounds...
But it kind of works.
But it sounds knockabout. It sounds as though I write farce or something, comic. If you ever see a book in a bookshelf that says, this is the funniest book, this is comic... I don't want to read
well,
that. There's a cartoon on the front.
It's terrible.
I don't want to read it.
It's like people who tell you also that you'll find a joke funny.
Yes, yes, or explain it to you. You don't... So... There's a whole problem for me with comedy. I value it until I'm called it. I will write essay after essay about comedy. I made a television series, 5 hours of television series. Nobody understood it because I was so complicated about comedy. What they actually wanted on television was, you know, these are a list of the 10 people I find funny. And I wanted to go into it all. Why is comedy so important? Why are clowns important in every society? Why are clowns sacred in some societies? Why are the most conservative societies likely to have at their carnivals and things the most disgusting clowns? What do we know about comedy that tells us it must subvert everything that we hold dear? What is it about comedy and opposites? Comedy is, if you like, life is tragic. Life isn't funny. Life is never funny. Life is tragic. Comedy is not a fact of life. Comedy is a human invention to deal with the sadness of life. We've created comedy. It's our greatest achievement. Forget the pyramids. Comedy. We made comedy. And so the minute you go near comedy, you're in the business of the way in which things are opposite, the way in which we create that which is opposite to what we know. So it's false, it's a construct, but it's necessary. So I argue for this against those who, Rabelais called them the adulast, the people who will not laugh. I've had people, ever since I started writing, there will be, there will always be 10, 15% of people who review me who go, it's not funny. I don't think it's funny.
Well,
very odd that people happily announce to the world that they've got no sense of humour. I don't find that funny. To which the answer is, well, that's your fault then, isn't it? That's not my fault that you don't find it funny. So those are one's enemies, and you deal with those. But then you come across something else. There has just been shown on British TV a dramatisation of Lawrence's Women in Love. It will come here. You'll get to see it. And I watched it thinking, I'm going to hate this, because Lawrence is very important to me. He's one of the great writers, who's not funny, but he's one of the great writers. And I thought, I can't bear this. It's fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic. And people in it say preposterous Lawrencean things about the blood and God and sex and things. And you just think, isn't this wonderful on television to hear people speak this extraordinary, poetic, yearning, fractured language in which they don't know? Isn't it wonderful to see characters in a drama searching for meaning? When you think almost everything that we have in TV drama, people know what they mean. They say what they mean. But to see, and that's what's wonderful about Lawrence, to see characters trying to find what it is that they mean, clutching words out of the air, just looking because life is so desperate. And then all the reviewers came out with, this is nonsense, Lawrence is a misogynist, get a life, Lawrence, and they just would not be serious. So although half the time I feel my argument is with people who will not be funny, the other half of my life is with people who will not be serious.
This leaves you in a difficult situation.
Yes. But I've got quick feet, as my mother noticed all those years ago. I've got quick little feet, and I can move between the two, fortunately.
One line I think that you've liked of Kundera is where he says, it pleases me to think that the art of the novel came into the world as an echo of God's laughter.
Yeah.
Do you agree with
yes.
that?
Whatever that means, I agree with it. I don't quite know what that means. I've never known what that means, but I like it. I like Kundera on laughter altogether. I think it's fantastic. The Book of Laughter and Forgetting is one of the great novels, and it's partly its subject is the importance of laughter. But for him, the importance of laughter is political. The importance of laughter when you're growing up in a political system, the communistic system, which did not permit laughter, because you can't laugh if you can't laugh. This is the other thing that's so important about laughter. It's not only you can't laugh if you're a conservative. You can't laugh if you're a left-winger. You can't laugh if you're a liberal. You can't laugh if you have a political position. Comedy and laughter are inimical. Comedy destroys. So when people ask me what my politics are, I can't have politics. I'm a novelist and I believe in comedy. I can't possibly have politics. Comedy makes a fool of politics.
You know, in thinking about tonight, I came across a passage I so much love of Ionesco, who was quite political himself, who says, humor is liberty. We need humor and fantasy. And respectable, in quotation mark, people have banished them from the theater and contemporary literature, where we find either the worldly spirit of the boulevard or the sordid literature, in quotation marks again, of commitment. This absence of
right.
humor, this
That's
ferocious
right.
commitment has been characteristic of our attitude for some time now. Hitler did not allow humor.
Dead right. Dead right. Dead right. That's a terrific piece. I didn't know the existence of that piece. I love what he said about commitment.
I'll pass it on to you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Laughter and commitment are enemies. You cannot be committed if you have laughter. The moment you commit yourself to something, you are finished as a laughing being.
Because laughing means that in some way you are unplaceable, you're nimble, you have long legs, you run fast.
Exactly. And you embrace skepticism. Embrace disbelief.
And you're somewhere different from where people think you're going to
yes.
be.
And you're always too quick.
And loving,
quicker than stern.
And loving someone in some way, in that respect, means someone with whom you share adjectives. Someone who makes you laugh.
Yes.
Is someone whose
yes.
language you share.
Yes.
Whose songs
Nouns
you share.
Nouns as well as adjectives.
Pardon?
Verbs.
Verbs.
As well as adjectives. Verbs, yes.
Which punctuation marks would you say?
Not too much punctuation. Because too much punctuation is too obvious. Commas.
Okay.
Commas, because commas are part of list, comma, and the great lists of comic literature. You and I have talked about this before.
We have, and we'll talk a little bit more about it. You mentioned the novelists you love. You held the pen of Dickens, and we have a novelist here in America who you've often been compared to. And I think you find it a little tedious, but nevertheless, I think you would believe that he's okay as a novelist. It's Philip Ross.
Yes, and nothing like as tedious as he'd find it if he ever, you know, if he ever heard it. It would drive him mad, I think. Yes,
but
I
to be compared to
yes,
you constantly.
Yes, Howard Jacobson is the English Philip Roth. Howard Jacobson is the English Philip. It was said about me from my first novel. And I hadn't read Philip Roth when I read him, but I sort of, people said he's the English Philip Roth, he's the English Saul Bellow, he's the English Woody Allen. And it doesn't take one long to spot that what they're going is, what other Jews? He's a Jew. What other Jews? They could have said he's the English Fagin, except that Fagin was already Jewish.
Did you detect some anti-Semitism
in
that?
No, I try not to detect anti-Semitism. You go on that route, you're in trouble, you know, that's that. You give your life to detecting anti-Semitism, and then you have comedy, you have to call
but,
comedy.
But Philip Ross, you have liked over the years,
yes,
but no. You haven't liked recently. You've
No, I think he's fun. I think he's incomparable.
But you think he's less funny now?
Well, I wished, it's his choice. He doesn't want to be funny now,
fine. Do you think there's a relationship between age and being funny?
I would like to see him being funny still, because I thought when Philip Roth made me laugh, that was as good as myself making my laugh. He was wonderful. Philip Roth really knew how to make you laugh. If he doesn't want to make me laugh anymore, any of us, that's up to him. But I think it's a shame. And when people say, well, he's older now and he's got more serious, I don't accept that definition, that when you get more serious, you get less funny. I think when you get more serious, you should get more funny.
That's what we were talking about before, is that in those moments of actually discovering that life is becoming more serious, you should be able to laugh it off, or at least...
No, not off. Inhabit it. Laughter is invigorating. Laughter keeps you invigorated. The thing I like to quote at this moment is Hamlet, the graveyard scene. There we are with death all around us, and Hamlet's digging away, and up comes the skull of Yorick, and he remembers how Yorick would make people laugh, and then what a great jester he was. Would keep the table at a roar, and then he points to the bones and he says, "Okay, get thee to my lady's chamber. Do what you used to do, jester. Get thee to my lady's chamber. Tell her, let her paint an inch thick. To this favour, to this aspect, must she come. In other words, tell her that however beautiful she is, she will be bones soon. Make her laugh." At that, and that for me is always, that's the great the credo of the kind of novelist I am. Make them laugh at that. Don't make them laugh at what's light. Don't make them laugh at what's, you know, easy and funny. Make them laugh at what's not funny at all. Then you're doing the business. Then you're being a great comic writer.
You know,
and I'd like to see Philip Roth doing that.
You know,
now.
And Saul Bellow, who you quoted earlier, said one doesn't love because but in spite. And
that's
in some way, you take everything into consideration. And nevertheless,
yes.
I'd like to play, if we could, clip number number 5.
I used to go to New York University a long time ago, which is in Greenwich Village. That's where I started, and I was in love in my freshman year. But I did not marry the first girl that I fell in love with, because there was a tremendous religious conflict at the time. She was an atheist, and I was an agnostic, you know. We didn't know which religion not to bring the children up in.
Could you try clip number 4? I think it's difficult to hear. Maybe clip 4 comes out better. The sound here isn't good.
I shot a moose once. I was hunting upstate New York, and I shot a moose, and I strap him onto the fender of my car, and I'm driving home along the West Side Highway. But what I didn't realize was that the bullet did not penetrate the moose. It just creased his scalp, knocking him unconscious. And I'm driving through the Holland Tunnel, and the moose woke up. So I'm driving with a live moose on my fender. And the moose is signaling for a turn, you know? There's a law in New York State against driving with a conscious moose on your fender Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturday. And I'm very panicky. And then it hits me. Some friends of mine are having a costume party. I'll go. I'll take the moose. I'll ditch him at the party. It wouldn't be my responsibility. So I drive up to the party, and I knock on the door. The moose is next to me. My host comes to the door. I say, hello. You know the Solomons. We enter. The moose mingles. Did very well. Scored.
Woody Allen.
Yeah.
This is Woody Allen at his, I think at his height, really. Woody Allen in the late 60s, early 70s as a stand-up comic. Yeah. Is he a model?
No. No, he's not a model. No, a model. No, no, but I think it's terrific. And I, just listening to that, I couldn't hear it all, no, but just listening to it, I realised what I think is essentially funny about that is hearing a Jew talking about an animal. That's why that's really, really funny. A Jew has got no business talking about a moose. You know, a Jew's and moose. What's the plural of a moose? Mice? Meese? A Jew and a moose live in...
They don't feel...
They don't inhabit the same... That's why that's fun. And then, of course, the other thing he knows is... The other thing that makes him a great comedian is he knows you don't stop.
Right.
The joke... I mean, for a Jew, a joke doesn't have an end.
No, that's true.
English think a joke has a punchline. The jokes don't have a punchline. A joke never stops. People have to go home, so that's when this... But otherwise, a joke never stops. Put a Jew and a moose together, that's a comedy without an end.
And there's a joke about the difference between the English and the Jews is that the English leave without saying goodbye. The Jews say goodbye without leaving. I don't know if you've heard that line, but it's always amused me quite a lot. But here, the relationship, I never thought that what really was making me laugh so much was the relationship between moose and Jews. But it's true. I mean, the relationship of Jews and nature is also quite... It's a short story, no? It's a haiku. The pastoral novel doesn't have a huge tradition in the Jewish tradition.
There was no Jewish
Very pastoral. Few.
Name me five great Jewish shepherds.
You should ask if your life depends on it.
And I assume this is why... I mean, we could get very serious about this.
Yeah, let's be...
But isn't the whole point of being Jewish that we said no to nature? We rejected... Jews... We're just speaking amongst ourselves now. Two Jews speaking. Paul and I rejected nature a long, long time ago. That's what it is to be Jew. That's what monotheism is. That's what everything that Jews believe in. We said no to nature. We would not have the way of nature. We interfered with nature. I actually think that this is why, that this explains, let's get really serious. This explains anti-Semitism, and it explains why there will always be anti-Semitism. Because somewhere or other, Jews are felt to be, because of their rejection of nature, unnatural. I'm being serious. I'll tell you when to laugh. The Jewish God is not a God of nature. The Jewish God, when you think of creation myths, other people's creation myths, monsters come up from the deep, and you know, natural forces fight. God is not a natural force. God is an intellectual will. Let there be light, and there is light. It's a creative act made out of his pure creative will. And he makes the world, and yes, it's the world as the sky and the rest of it, but he's not painting pretty pictures of the world. And throughout, I made a documentary about Jesus Christ's Jewishness, Jesus the Jew, it was called, two or three years ago. And I was travelling around in Jesus' footsteps, arguing for Jesus' Jewishness. And it occurred to me that one of the best arguments one could make for it is wherever Jesus goes, and the country is extraordinary, you go up to the Galilee and you realise Jesus never actually described where he was. He never said a poetical word about where he was. He had no natural appreciation. He was on other business. Jews have been on other business.
And so the business of having the business of being in a country that they feel belongs to them now is part of the problem.
Oh, aye.
No, but oi. No, but the no, no, no. I mean, I don't want to be too serious about this, but Zionism, I mean, I spoke with Yehoshua on Monday, and, you know, Yehoshua had this comment, which I found extraordinary on this very stage, to say that Jews who were not in Israel were, I mean, maybe that takes a little bit away from your oi, but he did say Jews who are not in Israel are incomplete.
Yes, I've heard him say that.
And I went home, you know, feeling fairly incomplete.
Incomplete. Well, let me help to make you complete again.
Okay.
Because while I understand what he's saying, the problem here is Zionism came along to settle what it's... one of the causes of Zionism. People are always going on about Zionism was to do with taking land off Arab. That's not what Zionism was to do with. Zionism was partly a liberation of the Jews from Jewishness. It was a secular movement, and I admire it as being a secular movement, and it's one of the things that upset me when I see Israel becoming more and more extremely religious again. I don't think that's what Israel was for. People, I mean, Jewish intellectuals were looking at what had happened to Jewish life in the shtetls and in Europe, and they were seeing Jews, on the one hand, talking about themselves as being chosen by God and believing in millenarian people, and on the other, living lives of poverty, of repetition, of just studying the same old text again and again and again, and signed to ritual, and people were saying, this is not a life. Even the cleverest Jews are merely, the Jewish mind has become sarcastic and bitter. This way of life is no good. What we need is the Jews to be in contact with something else. Get them out of those shtetls. Get them somewhere else. Free them from all that. And I understand that, and Yehoshua is a Zionist who's living the Zionist, there he is, he's doing...
And who believes that, you know, in Israel, the laws are made by Jews, the prisons are made by Jews, the schools, and us who live in diaspora, which is a word he looks upon as...
But we love the diaspora. This is the problem. Here is the contradiction, and I know it's a contradiction. I mean, I fight many a battle in England, against the forms anti-Zionism is now taking in England. Anti-Zionism, although they deny it, slips very quickly into anti-Jewishness in Britain.
Of course.
Dangerously so, and that's part of what the Finkler question addresses.
I was about to say.
But for all that, I also, I honour Yehoshua. And
so
all,
do I. But
I like being a diaspora Jew, and he would probably think, well, he does think that's false. We heard that noise, that's the noise of the diaspora Jew, finding the diaspora experience absurd and wonderful and ridiculous, and we love the fact that we love being outcasts. It's great being an outcast. I don't want to be a Jew among other Jews. I want to be a Jew fighting for the corner of Jews with English people or non-English people. And I can see the argument would be that this is sick. I see the argument. But it's a sickness to which I'm wedded.
No, and he says this so clearly. He says, you know, we saw it coming. I was talking to him about my father, who's, 92, and my mother, who's 86, and had they had a moral conscience, they would have known to leave in time, and et cetera, et cetera. And I was thinking, my goodness, such... You know what I did love about Yehoshua was a passion.
Yes.
The man at 75, at 76, is so passionate about the fact that I am incomplete.
Yes.
I mean, so deeply committed to the fact that all of us living in diaspora are just making a bad choice.
Yes.
And he said it to an audience, a large audience.
Well, good on him for having the courage to do it.
Yeah.
But I mean, one of the things you have to say is, what's so wonderful about completeness? Completeness is another sickness. I've only recently been introduced by my wife to the poetry of Leonard Cohen. I used to be above all that. Leonard Cohen, am I talking about the right person? Leonard Cohen, yeah. See, I don't even know. Leonard Cohen has got a wonderful song, the anthem song, about bells ringing out. And then there's a line that goes, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Imperfection. Is absolutely imperfection in art essential,
and you're very interested in that, particularly in ideas that come back to haunt novel upon novel, essay upon essay, and we'll move to that very quickly. The notion of failure, You're wedded to the idea of failure in some way.
Yes.
What's so fascinating?
I love failure. Well,
you love failure.
It's to do with this. There's a crack in everything. We are not interested in success. I mean, you in this country, and we now in our country, we think we are. But we in this room are not. The fact that you and I are here together, and the people in this room are in this room listening to me talking to you, means that they are not interested in. All right, I've won a prize and you're well known and but we're not really interested in. You don't read books if you're interested in success, as the world knows success. You go to read a book because somewhere or other you feel that the world is not quite right. If the world is right for you, you become a footballer. You become David Beckham or you become Donald Trump or something, and that's, you know, and you're
quite a range.
Yeah, fine, but there are a million ways in which, you know, you feel the world is okay, I'm going to do all right in this world, I'm at home, and me and this world can enjoy whole relations, completeness. We can be complete. This world will offer me something I want and I will succeed in it, whereas we all don't feel that. So you read books and I write books because we are wedded to failure, and we should be proud of that, in the best sense, the best sense. They say history is written by the winners. Literature is written by the losers.
And one of the things you said earlier was that in some way, in the end, we don't want this conversation to end, but we go on. We go on again and again and again, and we have this conversation. We look at each other in our eyes. We need each other more than we need to look into screens. We look at each other's expression. Yes. You take great joy in making me cry of laughter, though at the same time you're very interested in people who are crying. But one of the sports you're particularly interested in is a sport that you find particularly Jewish, or that Jewish people are particularly interested in because it suits them well. Let's listen, if we could, before we talk about it, about this fabulously Jewish Socratic sport called tennis table. Table tennis.
That's sex, isn't it? That's not table tennis, that's sex.
You have written quite passionately about the change in sound in ping pong. You wrote this essay, which I really like. Where was it published, did you tell me? Ping pong as a philosophical condition?
Yeah, there was a book called Pong, which was all about table tennis that was written, that was published here in America,
right.
But Roger Bennett edited it. And there's an essay by me, there's an essay by Harold Evans, there's an essay by a poem by Jonathan Safran Foer in it. People who love table tennis. And it's full of pictures and things. Very good book about ping pong. It's a very Jewish book, very Jewish game.
What is this relationship between Jews and ping pong?
When the very first person to win the world championships was a man called in the 20s. It was either 1929, I think. Was a professor of philosophy called Jacobi, and he won the game. And he was wearing, when you see him hitting the final shot, you see he's wearing a cardigan. When I started to play table tennis, my mother was very worried about what games, as all Jewish mothers are, what are you playing? What's with this? And they didn't like us playing football on hard, cold grounds in England. You play, it was dangerous. Cricket, have you seen what balls they play with in cricket? Dangerous games. Table tennis, you can play. I said to my mother, I can wear a cardigan when I'm playing. That's the kind of game for my ball. Look, the ball is light. You can't do any damage with the ball, in fact. And the truth is, the very first competitive match I played, and I was playing somebody, one of these.
And you're pretty good at it.
I was good.
Still now?
I was good. No, I don't play anymore. But I played this person. Now, for some reason, I saw it as a battle between the Jew and the non-Jew. For some reason, I Judaize everything. It's ridiculous. But this person I was playing struck me as having a particularly non-Jewish way of playing. He was just determined to win. He would hitch his shorts up and bang, got to win. Whereas a Jewish player goes, you get to a certain point in the game of table tennis and you see the non-Jew, you know, desperate to win the point. You think, you want to win the game, gesunte hate. Have the game. You can't. But I didn't feel that when I was playing this game. And this guy had a wonderful defence. He stood far back from the table, and he got everything back. And in the end, the only way I could win a point from him was to drive him far back from the table and then do the most wonderfully delicate disguised drop shots. So you're driving like that, and you suddenly stop it there, and the ball... And if you do a perfect drop shot, it just drops over the net. The drop shot you dream of is the drop shot that drops over his side of the net and then comes back, it's got so much backspin on, over your side of the net. This very nearly did that. And he came charging in to get it, smashed his knee against the edge of the table, went down screaming in pain, and was carried off in an ambulance. This is my first competitive match. And I felt, yes, I'd finally, you know, destroyed my opponent, won the match, destroyed my opponent. I've never done damage to anybody in my life, physical damage. And I was so desperate to go home and tell my parents what I'd done. But I realised if I'd told them that I'd sent somebody to hospital, they'd realise it was a dangerous game and stop me playing. So I had to keep this as a guilty secret for years that I couldn't. In fact, this is the first time, really, I've been able to rejoice in the damage that I did this month. I think he never played table tennis again. That's what damage I did to this guy. So it was a Jewish game because it was safe. He had a little ball.
And it was, in this essay, you say it's a Jewish game because also in some way it imitates, and I've thought this often, we've often had a ping pong table in this room that was a gift that we have on loan from someone here in the in the community, is that it is a repartee. I mean, between us now, and you articulate this marvelously in this essay. I'll read a few lines from it. But you articulate marvelously in this essay the fact that in some way you and I are having a ping pong game now. We don't really care. I mean, I think that mostly what I'm saying is right and mostly what you're saying is wrong. But we don't really care in some form or fashion.
Well, I care now. I was enjoying the game, okay, but now okay, I see. Okay, so you want to win? Okay. Gagas and Hague.
Exactly,
you want to win.
Exactly.
But it's true. But we are playing, and we're not trying to win.
Right.
And then something, and that's what table tennis was like, and that's why it was favoured by Jews. Won it. It was the one sport where Jews were winning all over the world, particularly the Austro-Hungarian Empire. As the Austro-Hungarian Empire crumbled, it just yielded. Everything was failure, but it produced very good writers and very good table tennis players for the same reason: failure. Table tennis is a failed game, isn't it? You want to be a great sportsman, you don't play table tennis, you play tennis. Table tennis, you go in the first game of table tennis. I dreamed of being I've dreamed of making a fortune playing table tennis, as does my hero in The Mighty Waltz. Mighty Waltz is more or less an autobiography. I dreamed that I would make a fortune. Nobody makes a fortune playing table tennis. And I thought beautiful women would fall at my feet. What beautiful women fall at the feet? I mean, I can't see how many beautiful women are in this audience. But I ask, you know, any woman in this audience, name me your 10 favourite table tennis players. Okay, five. It's so you go to it because you half know it's an absurd game, and you spend your life playing table tennis on your hands and knees trying to find the ball, scrambling for this little... It's an undignified game, but when you're playing it, it's intellectual and it's clever and it's witty. And then the game got spoiled.
And you write, I have never met an ex-table tennis player, once you've played table tennis, you go on playing no matter how old you are or how long it's since you competed seriously. I remember the times you lost more than the times you won. You remember your famous defeats. But this is not what I have in mind when I talk of the game staying with you. I mean philosophically. Table tennis, once you have played it with any purpose, becomes a very model for experience itself. It is quickfire, ironic music. And later on in this essay you talk, it is like art, the well-regulated, really take-up art. Why would you bother to remake the world if it were already fine in your eyes? So you make a whole philosophical comment about table tennis as if table tennis was a model for life, for a life lived properly.
Yes, and I think it was because none of us did well out of it. None of us prospered out of it. None of us had that mad will to... You know, when you're watching tennis, you watch tennis and there's a certain moment when you think, they're wonderful, the River, Federer, whoever, wonderful, wonderful. And then you think they're deranged. They are completely mad. The need to win is just bad. It's an illness. You said that what you're watching, if you're watching the final of the American or Wimbledon, is you're watching two ill things on the court fighting each other. Federer cried. They cry when they don't win. You can't cry when you don't win. You can't do that. No one cries when they don't win at table tennis. You cry when you win at table tennis. So unexpected. You don't... sport is... We think of sport being healthy. Sport, when it's competitive and people want to will, is sick. Winning is sick. And, you know, we'd all live in a much more healthy society if we didn't admire winning so much. Losing is what's good. Winning is sickness.
And you love talking. We were hearing that clip before. You love talking about the sound. You have this passage, which I love, where you say, I have mentioned the music of table tennis. I'm thinking of the sound the ball makes between the bat and the table. This sound has changed in the last 90 years as the surfaces of the bats have changed, first from cork rubber pimples, then to sponge, then to sandwich with pimples inverted and sponge beneath. The most suggestive music was that the ball coming off rubber pimple, a plain kerplock, which belied the devilishness of the spin and speed, could impart but sounded like frank conversation in which something was not quite said. Since then, as the technology has grown more sophisticated, the talkativeness of the bat has been silenced.
Good, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah, it's good. And it's true. What happened was that the Japanese invented sponge. They invented sponge and that was the end of the game. You didn't hear kaplop plop, you heard oof. You just heard the ball go oof like that. So you couldn't read the game. The game was no longer musical. It also got too fast. You couldn't play it in a cardigan anymore. They turned what was this wonderful game of intellect into athleticism. Which is spectacular to watch the way Asians now play, because it's now a game that's essentially
Asian. What we heard was that.
Spectacular to watch, except no one but Asians wants to watch it. No one wants, because it's over. They have a thing called the three-ball kill. You serve, the other person returns, and then you kill the ball. And if you fail to do that, you're no good. That's it, three-ball. So the thing that we're enjoying, the there and back, they're not interested in the there and back. By they, I mean the modern table tennis player. It's over. Do you know what the... I don't know where the people... There are secrets. It's like entering a secret society. If you go into table tennis now... I used to have a bat. And it was in a little
made
bag.
Made for you?
Bang. No, you just go out and buy a bat. Cost you nothing, and that's what you play with, a bat. With a plywood with some rubber pimples. Now you have... Now they carry huge bags, table tennis players, in which they have different plywood rackets, depending on who they're playing, and then they strip the rubber or the sponge or the sandwich off the racket according to who they're playing next. because if they're playing someone who's good at this or other, so they change the rubber to counteract the other person's game, so they study the other person's game, and then the glue that you use to stick the racket on with will also affect the code. You have sticky glue, slippery glue, you have all these different kinds of glues which change your game. For a while, the players were allowed to change their glues on the table. And then audiences started to faint because of poisons from the glues. So they couldn't work it out for a while. The game's got a little bit more boring. But do 5,000 people have to fall asleep while they're watching? Then they realised that the audiences were actually suffering glue poisoning. So now you have to have a gluing up room. So there's this room, and you go into this room, and you think you've wandered into a circle of Dantean, all these people crouched over with little glue tubes, and they're painting their bats, and then you have to, and the sponges come in squares like that, and you have to cut the square. So you carry knives, you carry glue, you carry knives, you carry a fret saw,
You know what it brings to my mind, what I think so amazed you in the pen of Dickens was just how simple it was.
Yes.
That things have become, that has become so complicated.
Yes.
I mean, I must say that the only sport I feel somewhat competitive at is ping pong. And recently I played Jerome Charin, who you probably know, the writer, and he's extremely good. Actually, I wanted him to come tonight, but he's playing. And
did you go against Jerome Chang?
Not well. And actually,
what was the score?
I don't think I made more than...
I beat Jerome Charin 21-10, 21-11.
When?
Just a few years ago.
When?
6-7 years ago. You're telling me he's got better since then?
No, I'm just.
He was at his height.
I just was going to say, shall we play a little bit?
People talk about those Charin's golden years when I beat him 21-12, 21-10. But we're not being competitive. It doesn't matter that I'm a better table tennis player than you. That's
not
important.
No, it matters to me now.
It
matters to me now quite a lot. But no, Jerome Charin, who beat me I think I made 8 or 9 points. Exactly. And, you know, he said to me, you know, Paul, you go to Paris quite often. And I say, I do. He says, there's a place where you should go in the 13th arrondissement, where they will make a racket for you. At your level, I wouldn't spend too much. I mean, it was deeply wounding.
Yes, it would be, yeah. Must be even more wounding to you to know how quickly I dispatched...
Well,
this person who gave you a hard time.
Well, I'm glad we're speaking about this towards the end of our
interview. But we're not on
the
line. You and I are not on the line here about... Well, we're not on the line about anything. We're certainly not on the line about who's the better table tennis player or who beats... We're above this.
Well, you are. What I'd like to end with is... I think one of the figures that matters to you very much is Rabelais. And in The Mighty Waltzer, you have a fantastic description of a meal. And I'd like you to read that page,
right,
if you would.
I will.
Because I think it is, it also permeates in some way your love of lists and your love of words. And I think...
And love of food.
And love of food. Which is something you would say is particularly Jewish?
I don't know. I don't think those qualities are Jewish. So the food I describe now is Jewish. I think Jews... Well, I mean, if we write about a Jewish joke never wanting to end, then the joy of a list is it never ends.
Right.
A list should never end. I mean, you stop because you have to stop somewhere. But the truth is a list just resounds into eternity, really. And this list of Jewish food, which is... I'll read some.
No, read the list of the various foods.
It's a kind of... I mean, this is a book, The Mighty Waltzer, is a book about goodbyes, really. It's a farewell to a life of innocent Jewish... The innocent Jewish life. I lived in Manchester in the 50s. Jews are different now. Manchester is different now. Table tennis is different now for the reasons we've spoken about it. And maybe, in a way, the way we eat is different now, unless the way we eat has changed. So this was what it was like then. Sunday was bagel day. Now that bagels belong to any old place, any old time, international convenience cuisine, it may be hard for some people to understand why they once counted for so much. Well, they tasted better in those days, for a start. Crispier, nuttier, crunchier, sweeter, saltier, browner, plumper, more burnished, more almondy, more floury, more boiled, stickier, more elastic, chewier in the dough, sleeker to the touch, more differentiated as to top and bottom, more variegated as to middle and sides, more distinct as to inside and out. The trek to get them was more arduous than it would be now as well. You had to choose whether you felt like Niedorf's bagels or Tobias's bagels or Bookbinder's bagels. Then you had to measure that against whether you felt like Niedorf's chopped liver or Tobias's chopped liver or Bookbinder's chopped liver. Then you had to divide how many they were likely to have left by the time it now was and get going. They would still be warm when you walk back in with them too, provided you haven't overextended yourself with the extras. But then if you'd underextended yourself with the extras, no one would have been much pleased either. Chopped liver wasn't the half of it. There was chopped herring, old-style chopped herring, and new-style chopped herring. The difference? Sugar, aroma, blind prejudice, and who could say what subtle variation of uric content. There was egg and onion, a yellow baby mash, new-laid and salmonella-free, which the aged and the toothless could suck up through a straw. There were cucumbers in a tin, in a jar, loose. Cucumbers plain, sweet and sour, just sweet, just sour, and new green. There were fish balls, and to give the fish balls taste, there was horseradish. Chrein, produced chrein, an old world ch with a convulsion of the larynx, which we, with our soft nursery palates, thought was fiery, simply because it was red. There were roll mops, not to be confused with Bismarck herring. There was Bismarck herring, not to be confused with roll mops. There were anchovies. There was smoked salmon. There were latkes. There was pickle meat with a dropped D, pickle meat, as though it was in itself in the active business of pickling and might pickle you. And then the Sunday morning ne plus ultra in our cow madhouse, there was smetana and kez, sour cream and cream cheese, that kind of cream and this kind of cream, which no one ever mixed with more dedication, more feeling for texture and consistency, more of an instinct for what looked alike but wasn't than my father did.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Lovely, lovely.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
And it was a good talk. Good talk. Good talk.
Howard Jacobson will be signing some books to the right here.